This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, back home here in Portland, Oregon, broadcasting from the banks of the Willamette River, which we are, as the glaciers are melting on Mount Hood, we are hoping will not flood this year, because I live in the river. And I'm back home for the first 3 days of the week, or first 4 days of the week. On Thursday, I'm flying to Reno, where Friday, on February 15th, I'll be doing a book signing at Borders in Reno. And on the 16th, on Saturday in Los Angeles, I'll be keynoting the Mensa conference there, which should be intimidating to me. Anyway, speaking of really smart people, Larissa Alexandrovna is with us. Larissa is, in my opinion, one of the finest investigative reporters in the United States. She works for Raw Story, rawstory.com, and has been following this case of Don Siegelman, the governor from Alabama, like a pit bull here. You've been doing a marvelous job. Larissa, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Larissa, set this up for us. I know we've talked about this before, but there may be people tuning in who are unfamiliar with who and what we're talking about here.
You mean in general the Don Siegelman case? Well,
yeah, and the fact that really, in my opinion, this is the best example that we need to be looking at, not the attorneys who got fired, the U.S. prosecutors who got fired, but the ones who didn't get fired. That's where the real scandal is.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. Basically, Don Siegelman was the incumbent Democratic governor from Alabama, and in 2002 he was running against Bob Riley, the Republican candidate, who ended up winning, if you can call it that, in a switcheroo kind of thing that happened in the middle of the night. And when he made some noise about this, that he wanted a recount, the ballots were sealed, and ultimately he's been indicted on the most bizarre charges that basically don't stand up to scrutiny. He can't appeal because the judge on the case, a Bush appointee, hasn't released the transcripts of the trial. And there are a myriad of other connections to the White House and this particular trial that really requires some intervention by Congress, if they're so inclined. So there's a handful of us who've been in our own pockets, sort of on different leads, working this story. One of the group of reporters is from CBS 60 Minutes, and they have been working on this on one angle of this story for about 7 months now. And that pretty much catches us up to what you and I were going to talk about today. Tom?
Hartman, we appear to be having a bit of a technical problem right now. I'll be back live with you in just a few minutes, but for the moment, just hang on and enjoy this music. And we are back. Well, Mercury's retrograde, you know, they say. What can you say? We lost our ISDN connection to New York, and our backup connection, our Comrex connection, apparently wasn't connected or all croaked at the same time. I don't know, strange stuff. Anyhow, we're trying to get Larissa back on the line. Ralph Nader, by the way, is going to be with us in a few minutes on the phone. But the bottom line here with the Don Siegelman story is that there is apparently, I mean, all this evidence that this was a political prosecution of a Democrat, and it's interesting. I was in Los Angeles over the weekend yesterday, reading the LA Times on the plane back up home And there was an article about the L.A. prosecutor and how he had prosecuted all these prominent political figures. And I was wondering, I wonder how many of them were Democrats. But is that Larissa on the line there on 10? Okay, great. Larissa, you're back with us.
I am. Apparently, I was talking to myself.
I think we just had some sort of massive disaster. But in any case, you want to finish the story here, and we'll push this break back just a little bit.
Okay. I'm not sure how far I got before I'll broke loose there.
Yeah. Well, you could start over, but let's do it quickly.
Okay. Basically, Don Siegelman was the Democratic incumbent in the 2002 election for Alabama's governor. Race, and his opponent was Bob Riley, the Republican, and there was this bizarre sort of switcheroo with numbers in the middle of the night, even though Siegelman was ahead. By the following morning, Bob Riley had won the campaign, I'm sorry, the election, and Siegelman was, he had tried to get a recount, but the ballots were sealed, and all of the key players basically are affiliated with the White House, and he was then prosecuted, which appears to be very much politically based and not based in anything really.
And basically locked down incommunicado for a long, long time.
Well, right. No one can. I mean, he has no access to the press. So, I mean, that's certainly disturbing. And and he's trying to appeal, but he can't until the transcripts are basically released by the court and the judge on the case, Judge Fuller, who is a Bush appointee, still hasn't released the transcript. So he's sort of in limbo.
Because of our technical problems here, Larissa, if you can stick around after this break, and then we're gonna try and move Ralph Nader to the bottom of the hour.
Okay.
And 60 Minutes was going to do this story, and they have apparently decided to pull back out of this. You still there?
Yes, I am. No, so. What happened was early last week, I was told by various folks in CBS, or rather in 60 Minutes, that CBS corporate was getting pressure from the White House and from Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, and that they were caving under the pressure. That is CBS corporate, not 60 Minutes. And, I mean, we've heard this before. There was a movie, in fact, made of this called The Insider. And basically, so, you know, I sent out a red alert of sorts asking people to call CBS corporate and demand that they show this feature they're doing on the Siegelman case. And others joined in, and it became a fairly aggressive campaign, grassroots campaign. And I found out this Sunday that on Friday there appears to be movement again from CBS corporate to air this. Now, whether that actually happens or not remains to be seen, but that's the latest, is right. That now they appear to be back on track for now.
So. Oh, that's interesting. That's good to hear. I want to get back into the details of this case and how it connects into Karl Rove and the White House and how it may be also be similar to other cases around the country with you. We're talking with Larissa Alexandrovna of Raw Story, rawstory.com. 17 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Stick around, Larissa.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right in these United States, not a privilege. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Remember that? How can you be alive if you don't have health care? 22 minutes past the hour. Larissa Alexandrovna is with us. She is the managing editor of investigative news at The Raw Story, rawstory.com. In my opinion, one of the best investigative reporters in the country. Larissa, in snapshot, it looks to the outsider, it looks to me, like what has happened here is here we had in 2002, we had an election where the Democratic incumbent governor, Don Siegelman, looked like he won the election. In the middle of the night, the Republicans changed the vote. They literally, you know, found 15,000 votes, as I recall, or something like that. They found a bunch of votes. And in the morning, they said, no, you didn't win the vote. And when he started protesting, they started prosecuting him to shut him up and put him away. Yeah, I mean, that's just how it looks.
You've basically summarized it. And I should say that we don't know that the Republicans, we don't have evidence showing that they flipped the votes, but there were some mathematical anomalies, to say the least.
There has never been an investigation of that, has there?
No. In fact, the Attorney General at the time, William Pryor, the Attorney General of the state, sealed the ballots. There was a request for a hand recount, and the ballots were sealed before that could happen. He was then appointed to the 11th Circuit as a federal judge in a recess appointment by President Bush.
So he has a nice cushy lifetime job as we saw so many of the people who went down, you know, with Tom DeLay and John Bolton and all these guys in the 2000 election and pounded on the windows to try and stop the recount in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
They all ended up, you know, being very, very well, handsomely paid off politically. Mm-hmm. And apparently Judge Pryor was as well. Others in this.
He's very close friends with and has been. Close friends with for many years with Karl Rove, as is Bob Riley's campaign manager in the 2002 election, Bill Canary.
Right.
They all go way back when they were to about 1994 when they were trying to stack the courts there with, so, you know, quote unquote conservative judges.
Mm-hmm. Now Bill Canary's wife plays a role in all this.
That's right. Bill Canary's wife is the U.S. attorney for the Middle District. It's in her district that all of the counts against Siegelman were handed
down. So she's the one who prosecuted Siegelman, her husband was the campaign manager of Bob Riley, the Republican who ran against him, who, in the opinion of some of us, the votes were flipped in the middle of the night?
That's right. Yes, and you would think that this would, I don't know, be alarming to the nation, but it doesn't appear to be, not yet anyway.
I mean, this sounds like something right out of, A, Banana Republic, or B, the old Soviet Politburo kind of stuff.
Ah, right, exactly. And since I happen to hail from there, I can tell you that it's making me at least very uncomfortable. But they're not the, Siegelman's is by far not the only victim of this, and that's, I think, the most alarming is that this is going on almost in every state, and he's just the most prominent.
So in every state around the country, we're finding Republican prosecutors, federal attorneys, who were put in office, not the ones who were fired, but the ones who stayed.
The ones who were doing their job, right?
Right, who are doing prosecutions selectively against Democrats and not against Republicans.
Well, that's not entirely true. They are also prosecuting Republicans, or another way they're doing this is destroying their businesses through countless legal things that they're doing. Republicans who aren't willing to play ball.
Mm.
And what our fourth installment is focusing on is, you know, this is not not only Democrats are being targeted, although they're the ones ending up in jail, mostly. Mm. The Republicans that are being targeted are people who quite literally won't hand over money, for example,
mm-hmm.
or won't play ball.
In
other words, sign off on things that are not entirely kosher. So it's incredibly disturbing, you know.
The Justice Department has become an arm of the Republican Party, of the hardest of the hardcore within the Republican Party, the Karl Rove branch of it, it appears.
Right, exactly.
Larissa Alexandrovna, the managing editor for Investigative News, rawstory.com. Larissa, thank you.
Thank you.
27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. 33 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot happening on the election front. We will be getting to that as we continue with the program. Also, some strange economic news. The Financial Times today talking about how the bubble has really not even begun to burst with regard to subprime mortgages. This is some strange and perhaps scary news. In the midst of all this, Ralph Nader is back. Ralph Nader, the author of The 17 Traditions, his most recent book, author of many, many, many books, The Good Fight, Civic Arousal, others, and also an attorney, a former presidential candidate. Ralph Nader, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Always great to have you with us. I understand that you are considering putting together an exploratory committee to run for president again.
We've opened an exploratory committee with a website, naderexplore08.org, to test the waters. And testing waters includes the many, many issues that are of concern to progressives that the Democrats and Republicans have taken off the table. And we've got to confront this very, very straightforwardly, Tom, because there's a underlying political bigotry here against candidates who are deemed to be progressive and are deemed to stay off the ballot to deny voters the choice that they want to make in the presidential campaign. Now, these are a lot of the issues you've discussed repeatedly. You've written books on them. But here's what's off the table by the Democrats and Republicans: impeachment of Bush and Cheney, single-payer national health insurance, the bloated, wasteful military budget, which the mass media has documented again and again, contains so much waste, fraud, abuse. Repeal of the Taft-Hartley anti-labor law. It's never mentioned by any Democratic candidate of any, except people like Dennis Kucinich. The whole issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that isn't even a subject for Sunday morning questions anymore as the destruction of Gaza proceeds. Aggressive crackdown on corporate crime, fraud, and abuse. Again, the mainstream media is documented from Houston to Wall Street. Opening up the presidential debates. A majority of the people in this country would like a viable third party, regardless of whether they vote for it or not. A majority wanted me and Buchanan on the debates, but it's a private corporation created and controlled by the two parties, and they don't want any competition. Now nuclear power is creeping up on the horizon, and that's on the table for Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Yeah. So these are major political issues representing a huge landscape of concern. We haven't even talked about consumer protection or environmental issues.
Right.
And so the basic question that progressives have to address is the one that Bob Herbert and Eugene Robinson have not addressed. Those are progressive columnists for the New York Times and Washington Post. Right. In the last few days, Bob Herbert has once again written a great column saying, where is the national vision? The major candidates are not espousing a national vision, by which he means the proper distribution of power, wealth, income, etc. And Eugene Robinson made this whole list of crimes of the Bush administration in his column in the Washington Post, and he never came to the conclusion, well, the founding fathers had a remedy for that. It's called impeachment.
Right.
So I think there's a major civil liberties issue here, and liberals have got to engage in a little introspection here, and progressive, and say, wasn't it great that there were some voters who were allowed to vote for an anti-slavery, women's right to vote, farmer populist, labor, progressive parties and little parties in the 19th century. I consider that progressives who say, do not run, and I haven't decided yet, still in the exploratory stage, do not run, equivalent to saying do not speak, equivalent to telling voters of a certain kind, do not vote.
Well, certainly running is one of the best ways to speak, and you've done a marvelous job of that in the past. We're talking with Ralph Nader, by the way, on his new website, naderexplore08.org, or naderexplore.com, actually. We'll also redirect you there. However, In the 2000 election, and I voted for you in the 2000 election,
right.
I think there was a lot of buyer's remorse. And in the 2008 election, David Cobb was the Green Party's nominee, and he did what you did not do in the 2000 election, which was say, hey, you know, I'm out here, I'm speaking, please support me, and if you're in a solidly blue state, please vote for me, but if you're in a red state or a swing state, consider voting for the Democrat, because we don't want the Green Party to be pulling away from the Democratic Party votes. I mean, we have, you know, we're one of only, I believe, five nations in the world that have first-past-the-post, winner-take-all elections. We don't have a proportional representation system.
Or a runoff.
Right, or instant runoff voting.
I mean,
you know, it's San Francisco is probably the largest of our cities. It's in more or less about 300 communities around the country, largely as the result of the Green Party's efforts. But are you going to make a commitment, if you run, to run the kind of campaign that David Cobb did where it won't harm the Democratic Party and it will bring these issues into the public arena?
See, that's where you and I differ. When you run for president, you run in 50 states. You don't start saying to certain voters in certain states, well, we're not going to give you the choice to vote for us in those states because we're really hound dogs for the Democratic Party. A much better way for Cobb to have done this was to ask the Democratic Party why it didn't pick up living wage. Why didn't it pick up single payer?
Well, he was throughout the campaign. He was taking them on constantly.
Yeah, no, but here's the point. Unless these great issues that you talk about regularly, every day, indefatigably, are moving into the political electoral arena, they're going nowhere. It doesn't matter how much mainstream press, how much headlines in the Wall Street Journal, Business Week, New York Times, Washington Post, talk radio, they're going nowhere. Now, for 20 years, Tom, I played this least worst game, you know, with the Democrats, Republicans. I mean, I actually had 12 full-time people in a campaign in 1984, showing the difference between Mondale and Reagan and so on. Not only did the press pay no attention, the Democratic Party paid no attention. They had great issues. One issue that was a spectacular one where the Reaganites wouldn't give $3 million for postage to notify a quarter of a million workers in foundries, factories, and mines that the Center for Disease Control physicians had documented were exposed to cancer-causing substances daily. And we gave it to Mondale. The Mondale's people said, no. We have a position where we're not going to spend any more money. I said, $3 million for postage? A quarter of a million workers? We had a press conference a few days later. It was all over the country. All over the country. Lead editorial in the New York Times. That's the kind of Democratic Party that liberals have to jump on and make demands, because if they have a least worst attitude.
No, that's what you have done so well over the years, and I so honor you for that. And I'm wondering, would you want to be considered the guy who caused John McCain to become the president at the end of the day?
You see, there's no proof of that in 2000.
No, clearly, I agree with you on that.
Here's the point. Would I want to be seen as someone who can make a very, very deep critique of McCain that the Democrats would not make? Yeah?
Would I
want to be someone who would let voters who want to vote for a progressive candidate vote for a progressive candidate? Yes. That's democracy. That's election. That's choice. That's diversity. Where are all these phrases when it comes to the rights of small parties and independent candidates who are obstructed and mercilessly harassed by one of the two major parties?
Well, this is the problem of the way that our government was set up. I mean, we came before John Stuart Mill did. We don't have proportional representation.
That's right.
But nonetheless, we
have to face it. We have to face the liberties.
I absolutely agree.
Here's the point. I'm not trying to debate
your candidacy with you here, Mr. Nader. You've been my guy for a long time, and I don't want to see John McCain president.
Yeah, no, neither do I. Now, I didn't want to see George Bush president. You should have seen our critique of George Bush in 2000, which the Democrats refused to pick up, including his record in Texas that Gore ignored after April of 2004. He never mentioned it again.
Yeah.
He gave this bumbling governor from Florida who left a lot of children behind a free pass. Now, here's the main point. We should never tell people who want to run for office, local, state, or national, not to run in order to deny their potential voters a choice of candidates. You can oppose them. Once they're in, you can oppose them. But you don't tell them not to run, because telling them not to run is, in effect, saying don't speak, don't assemble, don't petition, First Amendment.
Just like
they would never tell minority voters not to vote.
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting that you should not run. At all. I hope you don't interpret my words as that. I think these are the issues that you're going to confront, you know, right head on if you step into this, you know, as soon as you do. And so I wanted to bring them up. I'm curious. Will you be affiliated with the Green Party? Or are you exploring that again?
Yeah, we're exploring that, and you can see there's a very nice and unique letter actually written on the exploratory website by some of my supporters, including prominent Greens like Peter Camejo and Matt Gonzalez, who almost won the mayoralty of San Francisco, as you recall.
Mm-hmm.
And those and other materials are on NaderExplore08 www.tomhartman.org. Right. And keep an open mind, folks, because unless we find ways, to move these very, very important issues of health and safety and peace into the electoral arena, it doesn't matter how many marches. It doesn't matter. One of the reasons why.
Well, I think it does matter.
Huh?
I think it does matter. I think that there's a middle ground where we can be activists and we can be Democrats, but.
You're right. And you know how to do that? That's right. That's the alternative. You put your finger on it. If you don't want to go for a third party, you got to make demands on the Democrats.
That's right. Get inside the party, infiltrate it, take it over, or push it hard like you're doing, and I salute you for it.
Don't give it a free pass because it isn't as bad as the Republican Party, but plenty bad enough.
Agreed. Ralph Nader, I am so pleased to have you on, as always. NaderExplore08.org. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, audience.
And good luck. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey! Up every morning just to keep a job. I gotta fight my way through the bustling mob. Sound of the city pounding in my brain while another day goes down the drain.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop by our live chat room, airamerica.com, for the blog over there. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, great to talk to you again.
Thanks for calling. You had some thoughts on Ralph Nader.
Yeah, Ralph Nader is one of my personal heroes. He was the first person I saw speak in a political speech in a political campaign. Temple.
Mm-hmm.
And it changed my life. I mean, he inspired me to get active, kind of the same way you have with your tagline at the end of your show. I supported Ralph Nader in 2000 and 2004, sort of weakly, but, did a few things for him and then voted for him because I was in a strong blue state and really felt like I had the opportunity to vote my conscience.
Yeah, same here. We lived in Vermont, and Louise and I actually even still split our vote. She voted for Al Gore, and I voted for Ralph Nader. And mostly also, I wanted to make a statement, and I also wanted the Green Party to get a little more matching funds because I really like the work that they're doing at the local level all around the country to promote the idea of instant runoff voting.
And in 2000, I believe that was possible, that they could get 5%. I think they got 3-point-something.
Yeah.
But this time around, Democratic Party politics. I'm a trade unionist now. I'm, on the labor council and everything. But my union went with Hillary Clinton, and to me that was wrong. I feel like she's not inspiring enough. She's great, but she's not great enough. And I supported Kucinich and then Edwards, and then I just caucused for Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, I believe that Ralph Nader deserves to be in those debates. I believe that if Cynthia McKinney or David Cobb gets the Green Party nomination, that they deserve to be in those debates. To me, that's the real thing we should have learned from this year is how influential those debates have been.
Yeah,
people
exactly. Dennis Kucinich, over the years. Yeah, Dennis Kucinich did it to Howard Dean, and frankly, I think to John Edwards and then Edwards to the other candidates. Having multiple voices in the debates does move everybody in more progressive directions. It inevitably happens. And, Jeff, I'm right with you. I agree that it would be a good thing, a positive thing, if we could get more progressive voices. If the Green Party, for example, was invited to participate in the Republican and Democratic debates running up to the election, the way that Ross Perot did. Steve in Wisconsin. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Tom. It's a very good show, as usual. I can't believe you let Ralph Nader off the hook again with this Florida 2000 thing.
Ralph Nader did not cause Al Gore to lose Florida.
Okay, this is a lie.
Theft by the Republican Party caused Al Gore to lose Florida.
It is actually incorrect, Tom. If you remember, Al Gore had to go to the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court got a chance to do what they did because Al Gore won by George Bush won by allegedly 504 votes. And this is with all the Republican shenanigans, the 47,000 felon-listed black voters, right? Ralph Nader got 94,000 votes. Okay.
No, but the fact of the matter is George Bush sued at the Supreme Court. It was Bush who took that thing to the Supreme Court, not Ralph Nader, not Al Gore. Al Gore had to defend that.
You're missing my point, Tom. It would have never gone to the Supreme Court. 94,000 minus 47,000 is 32,000, right? Or something like that.
No, you are right that Nader being in the race in Florida caused it to be tight enough that the Republicans could steal it.
Exactly.
But it is wrong to blame Ralph Nader for the Republicans stealing an election in Florida. Because the criminals in this case, and I use that word very intentionally, were the Republican Party and Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris. Let's move on. I mean, this is, yeah. Tony in Bayside, New York. Hey, Tony.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
Nice show. Always like to listen to you.
Thank you.
Listen, the one thing I disagree with you is I'm all for political diversity, but the caller you just had a good point. Look, the enemy of my enemy
is my friend.
Yeah. And although Ralph Nader didn't cause the failure in Florida, okay, he aided it. And let's face it, this is a two-party system. It's always been this way. And, Tom, it's always going to be that way.
Well, until we get instant runoff voting. You know, Australia and New Zealand both have systems almost identical to ours. And what they did, the way that they solved the problem, was national instant runoff voting. We now have a lot of local instant runoff voting. We need to have more national instant runoff voting. And at the same time, I think it's important. I would advise Ralph Nader not to run, frankly.
Because you're intelligent and you're smart.
On the other hand, I don't think that he will pull enough votes to influence anybody. And if he does run, he may be bringing up these issues. So,
I hope people are not dumb enough to vote for him this time around, because all he's doing is draining votes away from the Democrats. You know that no single Republican is going to vote for him. So what good does he do us?
Well, I think it's important that he be out there raising these issues, which he does a marvelous job of. But as I said,
He can do that without running. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. He can do that without running.
Although when you run, you get a platform that you, in terms of the national media, that you don't get when you don't run. But to your point, Tony, I think that by and large, you and I are in agreement on this point.
Good.
Frank, and I appreciate the call. Frank in Los Angeles on K-Talk. Hey, Frank, got about a minute here before.
Nader irritates me to no end. He's a divider, not a uniter. Instead of uniting all the people with similar political ideals, to vote for the best of the worst evils, he's dividing them. And in Florida, what happened, John Ellis, who is the head of Fox News, kept saying that Nader won, Gore won. And so the Nader nuts they said they were going to vote for Gore if he was losing, they were going to vote for Nader if he was winning. So they fell for this and they voted for Nader, 90,000 votes. If 20,000 voted for Gore would have won without hands down, without even a question.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what this guy is thinking about. He has no chance of winning, so why is he dividing people?
He's trying to get these issues out, and he's pointing out that the Democratic Party, many elements within the Democratic Party, are frankly not all that progressive. And we do need, I believe, a national effort to move the Democratic Party in a more progressive direction. I just, you know, Ralph Nader thinks the way to do it is for him to get into the campaign. I think the way for us to do it is for all of us individually to get involved with the local Democratic Party and push them in a more progressive direction. Yeah, we have a difference of opinion, but, you know, I respect his opinions as well. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. Giovanni Gentile, ghostwriting on behalf of Benito Mussolini back in the day for the Italian the Encyclopedia Italiana, defined fascism as the merger of state and corporate interests. Are we there yet? Matthew Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive and editor of the Progressive magazine and the author of the new book You Have No Rights: Stories of America in an Age of Repression, one of my recommended books over at buzzflash.com. theprogressive.org/mag, the website, is with us. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you with us. You have done a marvelous job here with this new article, The FBI Deputizes Business. What the hell is going on?
Well, it's a bit of a shocker. It was a shocker to me as I was looking into it. It's about this organization called InfraGuard, which I'd never heard of before. And it's been around since 1996. It's a group of business people, an ever-increasing group of business people, that works with the FBI. Actually, the FBI has set it up, and the FBI supervises it state by state and chapter by chapter. There are 86 chapters around the country. There are more than 23 business people involved in InfraGuard, including representatives of 350 of the nation's Fortune 500 companies. And on one level, it's like a corporate tips program. These business representatives feed back to the FBI any concerns they have on security threats, but they also can sic the FBI on disgruntled employees, which is a bit alarming. But more alarming than that, these business people are treated as special citizens and that they get warnings of threats before any of us do. But most alarming of all, according to my sources in InfraGuard, they are preparing for a national emergency, and in the event of a national emergency, InfraGuard members have been told by the FBI and by Homeland Security that they are authorized and permitted to use lethal force, shoot to kill, to prevent their little aspect of the infrastructure, if they're a chemical company or if they're a utility company or if they're a cyberspace company. They can protect that aspect of the infrastructure in times of an emergency, and evidently they're planning on these emergencies and doing emergency preparedness exercises quite frequently.
Now let me get this straight. We have local businesses, mostly large companies, but obviously, you know, locally positioned all over the United States, where a local company, somebody working for a local company, a corporate officer, somebody who has never been elected, never been appointed, you know, is not a federal employee, not subject to the laws regarding federal employees, is not a law enforcement officer. Say somebody working for the local phone company happens to decide that he doesn't like me, and he could just phone in a tip on me, and suddenly, boom, I'm the subject of an FBI investigation, or you are, or our next-door neighbor is, A. And B, in the case of a national emergency, doesn't like me, could shoot me. Am I getting that right?
That's the main picture. I mean, if he or she, as a member of InfraGuard, thought you were threatening their aspect of the infrastructure, they are given permission to shoot to kill, and they are told that they would be there would be no repercussions.
And it seems like this is being set up as an old boy network, like you've got to be referred from somebody to get into it.
Yeah, it's kind of like an Elks Club of the FBI or something.
No, I'm serious. It does seem kind of like the Masons or something. It's
well, yeah, you need to be invited by an existing InfraGuard member. Then you need to be vetted by the FBI, and they ask you all sorts of questions, including whether you've ever committed a crime or not on the application form. All this is hidden in plain sight at www.infraguard.net. You can even see that application. And this has been going on, though, under the radar. No one's really written a piece on it, a big piece on it anyway. The only time it surfaced, interestingly enough, was in November of 2001 when Gray Davis, then governor of California, was notified that there was a threat to the bridges of California, notified not first by the FBI but by his brother, Barry Davis, who was working for Morgan Stanley and happened to be an InfraGuard member and heard before the governor of California heard that there might be a threat.
Well, now, I suspect that most Americans do not realize or remember or never learned that in the very early stages in Italy of fascism, Mussolini had his black shirts who were not affiliated with government. They were private, essentially corporation/club. And that Hitler had his brown shirts, who were also not members of, you know, a lot of people thought that was the army, or think that was the army. That these were private organizations that did the dirty work of essentially a political party and a political power, as it were. In this case, Mussolini and Hitler. Do you see any parallels here?
Well, it would happen after the United States were attacked again, but there are disturbing parallels. One parallel is to something that happened earlier in our history called the American Protective League. This was during the late years of World War One, when a Chicago businessman gathered together a bunch of other business people, 250,000 strong, and they acted as vigilantes, and especially went after the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies.
Right. So the very progressive union.
Right. So there's a bit of a precedent for it. But, you know, this idea that there are all these business people training with Homeland Security and FBI for what happens in an emergency, and then they are told by some of these agents that they can use lethal force in an emergency, I would hope that our members of Congress would call some hearings on this.
Yeah, this is like a bad caricature of Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jamie Lee Curtis's movie True Lies, you know.
Or a bad Bruce Willis movie.
Yeah, so any idea where this idea came from and when this got started? We're talking with Matthew Rothschild, by the way. He's the editor of the Progressive magazine, theprogressive.org, the website. The article, exclusive, the FBI deputizes businesses.
Yeah, it got started in 1996 in the Cleveland chapter of the FBI. The FBI chapter there was investigating, I believe, a cyber crime and got some help from some private companies. And they were so happy with the cooperation of the private sector that essentially the FBI cloned it in state after state, so that now in every state, and sometimes there are a couple chapters in each state, like in Wisconsin where I am, there's an InfraGuard chapter in Madison and an InfraGuard chapter in Milwaukee. And the thing has just mushroomed. After 9/11, there were 1,700 members about, and now there's 23,000.
Wow. Wow.
And FBI Director Tom, by the way, says InfraGuard members are the first line of defense.
Well, I thought our government was the first line. This is downright spooky. I agree with you. We do need congressional hearings on this. We need to find out more about it. And I so honor you, Matt, for bringing this out. Quick question, if I can just change the subject for a second. Ralph Nader was just on our program. You're one of the most articulate progressive voices out there. Ralph Nader was just on. He's put together an exploratory committee. NaderExplore08.org is the website. He hasn't decided whether he's going to run for president or not, but he's thinking about it. Your take on that?
Well, I love Ralph Nader. I used to work for Ralph Nader when I got out of college back in 1980. And, you know, he's going to do what he wants to do. I long since got over the idea that I or anybody could tell Ralph Nader what to do. And to the extent that he raises issues that others aren't raising, you know, I'm not one to say that's wrong.
Yeah. No, I say God bless him on raising the issues. I would probably advise him not to run. Although if he runs and he doesn't get any votes, or he gets very few votes, which, you know, happened the last two times, and his running raises issues that are not being raised by the Democratic Party and the Democratic candidates, then, you know, I see that as probably a net plus for our democracy. So,
I mean, Ralph Nader's been a hero in this country, and people have been demonizing him wrongly over the last 8 years.
I agree, and we've had a lot of callers on this, and I'm sure we will continue to as soon as we wrap up this segment. Any call to action here, Matthew, on this InfraGuard thing?
Well, my first call to action is for people to inform themselves. They can get our story at progressive.org. They can go to www.infraguard.net and get it from the horse's mouth. But then use this information to contact your elected officials and say, hey, did you know about this? What is this extra police force all of a sudden that's consisting of 23,000 business people? And why do they get all this information before the public does?
And it's working exclusively for the executive branch of government, for the president. It's not something that Congress created.
It's an extrajudicial wing of the FBI, essentially.
Right. So there's no clear congressional oversight other than to the extent that there is oversight of the FBI by Congress.
Yeah, the Justice Department should call the FBI on the carpet on this.
Yeah, well said. Matthew Rothschild, you can read all about it over at theprogressive.org. And the article is exclusive, the FBI deputizes business. Matt, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
I was talking on the telephone with Tony Blair. We was looking for intelligence that he would share. I need some information that they can't rebuke. He said Saddam was buying stuff to build a nuke. Well, let's roll. Everybody, let's roll. If I'm gonna play the game and score, well, then I have to launch another war. Well, making lots of money is a lot of fun. We make it by creating wars that can't be won. We'll blame it on Al-Qaeda nearly every day, but we'll never tell the sheep, well, it's the CIA. Well, let's roll. Let's roll.
You get down, Junior.
Well, gonna play the game and score.
Oh, 343 days, 10 hours, 30 minutes, 36 seconds until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office, assuming that he's not impeached. By the way, Tom Lantos died last night, and at the age of 80, a good long life, the only Holocaust survivor in the House of Representatives, a brilliant man. Harry Reid said, I am deeply saddened by the loss of Tom Lantos, one of the most honorable and admirable Americans to ever serve his country, whether standing up to fascism or standing up for families. Tom Lantos lived his life fighting for what is right. The Congress and the country will miss his courage. End of quote. And I just have to say the same. You know, Tom Lantos, really a truly good man in the House of Representatives. He will be missed. In the meantime, our piggies alert.
1 billion pounds, Dr. Kelly.
For the day.
Well, let me see. That would be 145 million and a half tons of the refuse.
Refuse.
Yeah. Probably there. And by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of
manure.
By comparison, the pyramid of the Pharaoh Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every four and three, you've got a pile of this excrement.
Yeah. That's the bigger piggies in their starched white shirts. And the bigger piggies are moving to London. This from today's Financial Times. General Electric is moving the headquarters of its core consumer finance division from Connecticut to London in a move symbolizing a shift in the U.S. conglomerate's center of gravity. GE Money's origins date back to the Depression in the 1930s when it provided credit for cash-strapped Americans to buy GE appliances. With $200 billion in assets, it is the world's largest provider of private-labeled credit cards. After the relocation of GE Money, two of GE's six divisions, including about a quarter of the conglomerate's annual sales, will be headquartered in Britain. And another note, this also from the Financial Times, this actually really startled me, and it takes a lot to startle me. I think it's Pilling, as it's probably how it's pronounced, Jonathan Sobel in Tokyo, Gillian Tett in London, writing in today's Financial Times. The headline, subprime credit loss heading for $400 billion, say G7 finance chiefs. This is the Group of Seven Nations, and their finance chiefs are saying, basically, you ain't seen nothing yet. The global policymakers have raised projections for the size of subprime-related credit losses in a move that implies financial institutions must increase their write-offs. In recent weeks, Wall Street banks and other institutions have revealed $120 billion credit losses. The U.S. Federal Reserve's estimate for subprime losses last year were only $100 to $150 billion. So, you know, and then they go on to say, but G7 finance ministers admitted it remained unclear whether much of the subprime pain would emerge, not least because the path of the credit crunch was uncertain. They're calling for prompt and full disclosure. And here's a quote from the governor of the Bank of Italy and chairman of the Financial Stability Forum. This is a committee of international supervisors and central bankers. He says, the next 10 days to 2 weeks will be crucial because we are going to have the first, this is what startled me, the first audited accounts from financial institutions since the crisis started. What? We're just now beginning to actually audit what's going on? And Jonathan Sobel in Tokyo, writing in today's Financial Times, central bankers outlined a package of reforms at the weekend designed to prevent a recurrence of the global financial crisis brought on by the collapse of risky U.S. housing loans. And then they talk about how the G7 finance ministers warned that the full impact of the credit squeeze has yet to be felt. Bankers have written down about $100 billion of exposure. He said banks, pushed by regulators where necessary, must quickly disclose the extent of subprime-related losses and replenish lost capital. Remember the news conference the Bush administration had where the guys came out with hedge trimmers, and one actually showed up with a chainsaw to say, we are cutting through the red tape, we are doing away with the regulations, we are going to deregulate the banking and mortgage industry and let the market prevail. And the problem is, there's no such thing as a free market. The ground in which the market grows is government. Government provides the rules of the game. It provides the court system through which contracts can be enforced. It provides the police departments that ultimately can enforce a contract if necessary. It provides a stable currency. Government is the soil in which business grows. And regulation, reasonable and rational regulation, obviously there's always going to be a debate about exactly what that means, but reasonable and rational regulation is what keeps capitalism from becoming cancerous. And I would submit to you that since Reagan became president, we have seen the cancer stage of capitalism coming upon us. Hard and heavy and fast. And this is one symptom of it. Only one of many. And it's time for us to turn back from that and say, you know, John Maynard Keynes and Franklin Roosevelt really had something to teach us. There really is a role for government in making sure that we the people are protected. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
That's democracy! It's magic! And it works! 34 minutes past the hour. Well, the buzz right now is, will John Edwards endorse either Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton? Apparently, he's not all that excited about Obama's health plan, but who knows? I don't know. There's a whole bunch of different policy considerations and as well as electability and as well as basically, you know, just who he's going to go with. Apparently last Thursday, Hillary Clinton flew out to South Carolina and met with him. And today he's meeting with Barack Obama. And so it's going to be very interesting. We will keep you up to date if it happens during the noon to 3 p.m. Eastern time when we're live on the air. We will surely let you know as soon as we know. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Raul in Long Island, New York. Hey, Raul, what's up?
Hi, good afternoon, Tom. I like your program. I listen as often as I can.
Thank you.
And I respect Mr. Nader, and I admire a lot of the things that he has done. He is right that the two-party system is too narrow, and it leaves out a lot of people, a lot of issues that might not be aired under the current system. My problem with him is, and I actually would have a lot more respect for him, and maybe you would even support him, if instead of just popping up every 4 years to siphon off votes, he would actually build a third party from the ground up. I mean, in order to have a third party and create a forum for all of these different issues that he brought up, which are all very important, and he's right. Many of them get short-shrifted in the coverage today. But who is he kidding if all he's going to do is show up every couple of years and siphon out votes? He has to build a party structure.
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is, Raul, that Ralph Nader is on an ongoing basis talking about these issues. It's just that the press doesn't cover it because he's not a presidential candidate when he's talking about them.
Oh, I give him credit for that.
That provides him with a certain platform. You go to his website. You know, I just signed up on his website, which takes you to the next page. And he says, maybe we're wrong. That's the headline. Maybe we're wrong.
I saw that.
Maybe the Democrats and Republicans will nominate presidential candidates who will stand up against the war profiteers, the nuclear industry, the credit card industry, the corporate criminals, big oil, and the drug and health insurance industries. We doubt it, but hope springs eternal.
Right.
And so,
yeah, I read it while I was waiting. I also went to InfraGuard. That's a very interesting organization.
Yeah.
It's scary.
InfraGuard,
but sticking with Mr. Nader, if he doesn't have a party structure behind him, and let's say through some miracle he were to win, if he were to run, then who would he caucus with? Who would push his issues through the federal legislature?
Yeah, well, like you know? Bernie Sanders, who's an independent, he would have to learn how to make friendly with the Democrats and
exactly.
caucus with them. Yeah.
The very two-party structure that he has criticized.
Right.
This is
the problem. And Raul, thank you for the call. This is the problem that, you know, that James Madison identified at the very beginning was with first past the post, winner take all elections, which we have in this country. Without an alternative, and at the time they hadn't thought of proportional representation, and they certainly hadn't thought of instant runoff voting, without an alternative, you have a two-party system. It's built into our Constitution. It's not named that way, but it's built into our Constitution. John in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, John.
Hi, Tom. Hope you're having a nice day. I am. Feeling much better. I'd like to say that I think the people who blame Nader for 2000 forget what happened in 2004, that election was stolen from Kerry, and so... And the story about Siegelman.
Yeah, and still there's over 100.
Another example. But I remember Bush was positive in 2000 that when he was told that Gore had been declared the winner, his reaction was to say, that's not right, I have to call my brother. So as far as I'm concerned, if no one had voted for Nader, Florida still would have stolen another 90,000 votes, and he still would have taken Florida.
Yeah, they would have figured out a way. I suspect, John, that you're absolutely right, because they sure did in Ohio. Richard in Jacksonville, Florida, speaking of Florida. Hey, Richard.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I was thinking about Ralph Nader, and the thing that I thought about him was that why does he run as a Democrat? Why can't he run as a greener, blue Democrat?
Well, he can't run for president as a Democrat because, you know, the time has run out. He would have had to get, you know, into the primaries way, way back when.
Right. That's one of my points. He basically doesn't want to go out and campaign. He wants to stay in his own little green party in his own little green world. Basically, I don't know if he's egotistical, but he basically wants to have...
Well, find me a politician who's not, Richard. I mean, it's actually a necessary attribute, I think, at a certain level. But, you know, I don't think that Ralph Nader is motivated, frankly, in this by ego any more than he has been throughout his career. Ralph Nader has been a tireless crusader for the causes that he believes in. I've disagreed on occasion with his tactics, but, you know, he's a good and decent man, I believe.
But mostly he sides with the Democrats. So, I mean, why would he basically want to be in that situation?
Yeah.
He would have to go through the primary process like every other candidate in the Democratic Party. He would have to basically, you know, run his campaign.
Well, and I can't speak for him, but my guess would be, and Richard, I got to move along, but thanks for your call. My guess would be that his response would be that he's taking on those folks who are contributing to the Democratic Party, and therefore he wouldn't be welcome. I don't know. Elena, am I pronouncing that right, in San Francisco?
You are, Tom. Hi.
Hey, Elena.
I want to thank you for having Ralph on, because I have already decided that if it comes down to one of the front runners in McCain, I'm not going to vote. I would vote for everything else, but I'm certainly not going to vote for McCain. But I've talked to lots of people campaigning for both Hillary and Obama, and when did it become okay? Why is misogyny... not only okay, but even cool and funny? I've heard so many things like bros before hoes on T-shirts, on people that look reasonable.
Hmm.
And why didn't Hillary marry OJ? And this is someone who's supporting Obama, and I hear these things, and it's like, I can't support him. Maybe they're not coming out of his mouth.
I guarantee you they're not coming out of his mouth, and he would not have anything to do with that. And just because somebody who might be supporting him is wacko doesn't mean that that's the candidate.
I've heard a lot of it, and I haven't heard any racism coming out of Hillary's camp, which I would be as quick to squash that and be sickened by that. But their records are so similar that there's really no other way to judge them. You know, unless you're just going to go with this gut feeling, oh, I feel good when Obama speaks, I hear music. I actually heard a guy tell me that, too, that I had to vote for Obama because when Obama spoke, he heard music.
So your bottom line is that you will vote for Ralph Nader if he's on the ticket?
Yeah, I would vote for Ralph Nader, and he's not a Green Party person. The first time he ran as the head of the Green Party, the second time he ran, I don't remember what he ran, but it wasn't the Green Party. And I don't know what he would run this time, but... I think that we've been held so far to the right that, good for him, we need to be pushed to the left. It's past time, and if we go a little too far left for my comfort, you know, we need to fix a lot of things that the extreme right's done.
There's, well said, Elena. Thank you very much. And there's no way we're going to go too far left.
It
just ain't going to happen. Not in this country. We've got to get back to the middle. You know, things like, you know, a national health care program and unionization and control, you know, regulatory control of corporate criminals and things. Weldon in Minnesota. Hey, Weldon, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I was just going to ask you just a few quick questions. I was rereading your paper that I read yesterday, When Democracy Fails.
Yeah, it's also a chapter in one of my books, I think in Screw, in What Would Jefferson Do?
I found it on the net, so I was rereading it yesterday, and it, you know, in light of your last couple of guests, I'm almost starting to get scared where, you know, we're really starting to slip into fascism.
Yeah, don't get scared, get active.
Well,
that's the remedy.
That's basically what I've been trying to do as much as possible, just through email and that thing, but... Mm-hmm. My question is, when I listen to Barack Obama or any of these guys, I think I'm hearing, you know, sort of an allusion to prosecuting Bush and Cheney. And I'm just wondering, at what point can they start talking about it?
Not until after the election.
Which election?
After the presidential election in November. Yeah. After the presidential election and before the inauguration would be the time. And frankly, that's the time when I think that those of us who consider ourselves part of the impeachment movement, who believe that these guys should be impeached, and assuming that there is no impeachment between now and then, and that, by the way, is not necessarily a solid assumption because John Conyers is making some noises. But if there is no impeachment or there is no impeachment movement, that would be the time to start a prosecute the criminals movement and try and turn it into a very high profile thing. So that's what I would do.
I've heard of some rumblings about, you know, because Americans don't want to submit people to the Hague because they, you know, it's outside of American justice.
Yeah, no, and that's the problem, or that's a problem. But, you know, sometimes the Hague can reach out. I'm not sure. Weldon, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. Louise in Redondo Beach. Hey, Louise, got about a minute here before this break.
Oh, hi, Tom. Love your show, love your work, and I can't wait to meet you on the Air America cruise in 2 weeks.
Yes, I'll be there for the last 3 days, I think, of the cruise, and I'm looking forward to meeting everybody there.
Yay. Okay, first comment on Nader. The fact of the matter is I believed in every single comment he made just a few minutes ago and actively support the issues that he raises. However, the political reality is that our current structure of government will simply not allow someone like him to win. And being that the stakes are so high, they have never been higher in a presidential election, I feel that the best course for him to take would be to perhaps endorse Obama, for example, and also
and push like crazy.
Have him raise those issues in the debate with McCain.
Absolutely. Louise, I'm sorry we're out of time, but your point is absolutely well taken, and I agree. And this is where he's saying if he is a Green Party nominee and he can get into the debates, he can raise the issues. I don't think it's going to happen, but wouldn't it be great? 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Hello. Now hush. Don't say a word.
The NSA song.
It's enough to know my words are being heard. And we're fighting freedom here at home. So we don't have to fight it over there. Now my own sweet Marie never listens to me. Not my brother or even my mama. But when they're on the line, I know you hear me whine. Take that, Osama. Won't you please tell Condoleezza I ordered extra cheese, and I love her, 'cause she's out there.
Here's how I know.
stain on a dress, but a leak nonetheless tells me so.
Hello, NSA. Welcome back. The Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEU 1199 fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Janice in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Janice.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call, and I do want to say, I keep forgetting to say this, but your screeners are great. I love them.
Thank you.
They're also very nice.
I agree.
I want to echo a woman who called a couple of callers ago when she was talking about misogyny. I tell you, I wasn't a Hillary supporter. I have become one. I mean, you know, because we have these two choices now. But what bothers me about Barack Obama supporters is that when you say anything about him, it's like, first of all, they're not even informed, or else they don't want to hear it. I was at a Democracy for America meeting Wednesday night. I had this very experience trying to say, well, do you realize that, you know, pointing out votes, and it was like she didn't care,
mm-hmm.
you know. And this morning, they showed Barack Obama speaking about this weekend, and then after that, they put Bill Clinton on. They didn't have Hillary Clinton speaking. They just had clips of her signing, doing signatures.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean,
you see,
I
this
just,
as a media bias against Hillary.
Yeah, and I don't. It's not that I'm bashing Barack. It's not that at all. It's that he's been allowed to package himself in such a way and get away with it, and so therefore we're not really voting for a true person.
Yeah.
You know.
You know, Janice. The reality is that according to really good scientific, sociological, psychological, political surveys and studies, and I quote some of these in my book, Cracking the Code, 93% of American voters make their decisions not on issues, but on emotions, on
right.
how they feel about a candidate. 93%, only 7% of American voters carefully examine issues. And so I would say, you know, if you talk to somebody who was a fill-in-the-blank supporter, you know, anybody, any kind of supporter, and
right.
you said, hey, what about issue A, B, and C? And they said, oh, I don't care about that. I'm still going to vote for this person. That person represents the vast majority of American voters. And
there's my frustration.
Well, I agree. And those of us who are policy wonks and issue wonks and, you know, really care about the issues and all that, you know, we get very upset about that. But that's the reality. And so what we have in America, and we've had in America, frankly, I think this goes all the way back to probably the election, the big battle election, the first big battle election, which was Jefferson versus Adams in 1800, which was referred to as the Revolution of 1800 by some historians.
Uh-huh.
I think that it goes back to that a politician, regardless of their policies, also has to figure out how to package themselves. And so that's what you're identifying. And Janice, thanks for the call. The point is well taken. And, you know, it's the reality. We've got to deal with it. Let's see. Is it Perrin in San Francisco?
Yes, it is.
Hey, Perrin, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I've been noticing the media making a huge error, either by omission or commission. I'll let listeners figure out why it is. But you notice every sentence out of McCain, and when Romney was running, every sentence out of him, his mouth was about the Democrats want to wave the white flag of surrender. Everything McCain says is about, I was for the war in Iraq, I just didn't like the tactics, and now that the surge is working. And what my call is about today is, who says the surge is working?
Right. It's got nothing to do with the surge. It's got to do with the fact that the major Shiite leader in Baghdad has declared a six-month ceasefire, and he's just decided to extend it, Muqtada al-Sadr, and
right.
that we've been paying three to $500 a month, which is $500 a month was the average income of the middle class in Iraq before we
right.
invaded. I mean, so $500 a month is big bucks. We're paying Sunnis who used to be shooting at us to not shoot at us.
Well, that's
exactly
the question. And,
the
Tom, I've been, like you said, get active, get involved. I've been calling major members of the media, and there are some networks where you can actually speak to the reporters that do the story. And I say to them this question exactly. After 5 years of war in Iraq, we have to pay somebody to shoot at other people as opposed to shooting at Americans.
Right.
And I said, how is that winning hearts and minds? I said, here in San Francisco, we've got a section of town where you can pay people to love you. and you can pay them by the hour, you can pay them overnight, but I guarantee you when you stop paying them, they'll stop loving you.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I think that your analogy between prostitution and paying off some of these Sunni militias is actually a fairly reasonable one. Because that,
yeah, and
that,
it's exactly,
you know,
what happened in Afghanistan with the Northern Alliance. We paid people on the battlefield with $100 bills to say...
well, hey, take it back before that. We were paying Osama bin Laden and his buddies to help throw out the Soviets.
And Tom, let me ask you this, and if you know the answers to any of these questions or any of your listeners...
It's got to be quick, Karen. We're out of time here.
All right.
Well, okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. We just, you know, this, it's the top of the hour and it's the tyranny of the clock. But thanks a lot for the call. 57 minutes past the hour. And it's the Tom Hartman radio program. Coming up, Peter Swire is going to be with us. Professor Peter Swire from the Center for American Progress about black box sensors on private sector computer networks.
The Tom Hartman program. Tom Hartman. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Backed off a little bit on some protections by having a series of cases that I think are very controversial and probably wrong. They're saying that once you give your records to somebody else, that somebody else can give them to the government. So, for instance, the government's view is once your emails are sitting on some server somewhere, it's the company that has those emails in its computer that can voluntarily give them to the government. And so this third-party holder of records, the fact that online companies or whoever it is holds the records outside of your house,
mm-hmm.
the court is saying that's not protected by the Fourth Amendment.
Or presumably your telephone conversations as well, since everything is digital these days.
Right, and so the one thing is, so far the courts have said, you know, what you actually say in your phone calls, that gets Fourth Amendment protections. Of course, even then, if you're calling overseas or it's part of this FISA stuff, that's a different mess.
Yeah.
But the basic story was, if it's inside your house, they need a warrant. If it's your phone call, we know you've got a constitutional right. But other things outside of the house, it's a lot scarier than you might think.
In today's Wall Street Journal, there was an op-ed or an editorial on the FISA legislation that's being debated right now. And that's really, I think, you know, one of the most urgent issues of our time and of our day. And in this, let me just share three sentences from this with you, if I may. Not long ago, this is the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal writing, of course, owned by Rupert Murdoch now. Not long ago, Democrats seemed ready to move a bipartisan bill passed by the Senate Intelligence Committee last autumn. But under pressure from the anti-terror left, they are now bending and will try to weaken the bill on the Senate floor. By far the worst threat is an amendment from Senator Chris Dodd, Democrat of Connecticut, to deny legal immunity to telephone companies that cooperated with the government on these wiretaps after 9/11. Now, first of all, my understanding is that this wiretapping by the Bush administration actually began before 9/11. And secondly, this characterizing anybody who's in favor of the Constitution as the anti-terror left strikes me as bizarre.
Right, it's the politics of fear that, you know, we've seen over and over again. When I was in the White House, I was asked by the Chief of Staff, John Podesta, to chair a task force to update our wiretap laws for the Internet age. So I was in there with Department of Justice and NSA and all the three-letter agencies. And there are times you have to update the laws and make sure things are effective.
Sure.
This telecom immunity is ridiculous. There's been so much deception about it, it just annoys me. Earlier today, I was talking to a longtime federal prosecutor, and he agreed with me on this. So the phone companies for years and years and years have had lawyers, armies of lawyers, who look at the request from the government and they say, this is okay, this is not okay, this is okay, this is not okay. The rules are on the books. They knew what to do. What they're trying to do now is...
And in fact, one of the phone companies, I believe it was Quest,
yeah,
said, no, we're not going to do that.
Yeah,
oddly, the president of Quest is now in jail.
And then after that, there was the securities investigation of him, and we'll never probably know if the two were linked or how that worked. I mean,
right.
You know, it's a scary thought that would work that way. But here's the thing. The phone companies and the government had legal ways to do wiretaps, legal ways to share information. You just had to follow the rules and not just go wide open.
Right. Just go to a judge, go to the third branch of government, the judiciary.
And there were a lot of ways to do it, including with emergency orders. If they broke the law, they broke it knowing they were breaking the law, being the biggest experts in the world on breaking the law, and they just decided they didn't care anymore. And what happens is when you break the law, you get consequences. So this idea that the phone companies were somehow put in an impossible position is flat out wrong.
Could it be that it wasn't that they broke the law saying that they didn't, you know, they flat out didn't care anymore, but rather that they broke the law with the assurance of the Bush administration that their backside would be covered and not to worry?
Right. So some of the critics of the phone companies point out that the phone companies have had mergers approved. The phone companies have had a very sweet regulatory regime for the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the phone companies were playing really, really nice with the Justice Department and the intelligence agencies.
Right.
And so there's a whole concern that there was a political bet here on the side of more surveillance and getting what they wanted out of the regulatory system. And that's a concern, a calculation that it's hard to tell from the outside, but it's something to worry about.
Yeah. And how will we know? I mean, here we have a situation where the Justice Department...
Get a new administration that cleans up the mess.
Well, okay, when Bill Clinton came into office, there was laying all over the ground for the, you know, and those of us who were paying attention, I mean, all kinds of evidence of major felonies that were committed during the Reagan administration. I mean, the Reagan administration, the stuff that they got caught at was pretty bad. More senior officials in the Reagan administration were convicted of crimes or sent to jail than in any other administration in the history of the United States. It was the most corrupt administration in history. Clinton and then George Bush Senior comes in, and you know the same actors continue the same behavior, and the whole Iran-Contra thing had not been resolved. And Bill Clinton just basically said, "Okay, we're going to move forward. We're going to abandon these prosecutions, and we're not going to look at this stuff." Don't you think the odds are that if Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama come into office, you know, or I guess that those are the two.
I think those are the two main candidates.
That they probably will do the same thing that Bill Clinton did, and just say, enough already? And if that's the case, how can we prevent that from happening? How can we say,
well,
if there's a new administration, there's actually going to be investigations and prosecutions?
Well, so one thing you hope is that you hope that the procedures get fixed so that going forward, good things happen and bad things don't happen.
Right.
And so that for sure is the job for whoever the next president is. And, and that goes to not doing any more torture, and it goes to not breaking any more, you know, wiretap laws going forward. The second question is, how do you use your discretion, and who do you go after, and who do you hammer, and how much of your time and energy do you spend on that versus looking forward and doing things for the American people going forward? Those are hard questions. If you were the Attorney General figuring out how to do your new things, you'd have to be making those decisions.
So is there an organized, to the best of your knowledge, an organized campaign, as it were, for lack of a better word, to hold these guys accountable? It seems to me, what I've been arguing on this program,
mm-hmm.
is that the impeachment movement, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore, basically,
right.
sector of the American populace,
right.
needs to morph itself into the prosecution movement and
well,
say...
Well, I think if it's clear, and especially when you have relatively clear facts, right, so where there's an individual who did something that broke the law and you can prove it, then you have a chance to do that. But and so I think that what you're saying, which is have the mad as hell folks say we need to hold people accountable,
right.
I think that'll be heard. So I'm not going to tell you not to do it. I'm just saying the people in power in the new administration who are trying to get new things done might make it more of a priority a lot of times to figure out how to fix tomorrow rather than spend a lot of time going after who did something the day before yesterday.
In your professional opinion.
Right.
Professor Peter Swire of Professor of Law at Ohio State University. Did George W. Bush break the FISA law? And that law, as I recall, calls for 2 years in prison for every violation. Did he?
Well, I think there's a lot of evidence that the NSA wiretap programs and these secret splitters, you know, in San Francisco and the rest, I think there's a lot of evidence of violation of law. Now, whether you can get an individual beyond a reasonable doubt did something that lays up to their legal standard, I think that's another seven steps.
But he has publicly said that he authorized these wiretaps.
Well, again, if you do things on the advice of counsel in an area where it's debatable,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be very hard for the next prosecutors to get beyond a reasonable doubt.
Interesting. That's very interesting. So, well, that's a tough one.
Yep.
It is.
I don't know if you wanted to hear about these black boxes. This article.
Yeah, please.
There's this new story that the Wall Street Journal broke last week about $6 billion in the president's budget.
Right.
And black boxes where it would be direct feeds to the federal government for what happens in private computers. We went down that road before. It got public a number of years ago. That program got stopped because it was a bad idea. Private
and
systems shouldn't be under that kind of thing. And so at the Center for American Progress for Peter Swire, you can read about this this thing.
Great. PeterSwire.net or Center for American Progress. Thank you, sir.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
If there's something you've got to believe in, then the message must get through. So don't just sit in silence when you know why. Turn it up. Turn it up.
21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Listener-supported radio here, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors and our affiliated stations. Let them know that you're listening. Let them know that you care. Professor Peter Swire, we were talking in the last segment, and I kind of went off on a tangent on this FISA thing, because I think that this is a really important issue, particularly given that it's being debated in Congress again. But the article that you wrote about the black boxes that are being attached to private sector computer networks, we really didn't get a chance to get into that, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to tell our listeners about this.
Okay, so here was the story. The Wall Street Journal says that there's a new cybersecurity idea. Government has a good idea of putting black boxes on private security, private computer networks. So
Local ISP.
It could be the local ISP. It could be company computer networks. The government says they want to do it because that way, if they see attacks happening to Microsoft, Google, and big companies, if they see attacks to little companies or banks or the ISPs, they'll get an immediate red alarm alert. They'll be able to respond quicker and stop the bad guys. There's a bunch of things wrong with this.
Good.
One is, we've seen it before, and everyone who looked at it said this was a stupid idea. One problem with it is, if the government puts a black box inside Microsoft, inside Google, inside Yahoo, inside all the companies out there and banks, these companies now have a security flaw. They don't know what's inside the black box. They don't know what the government computers are doing to them. So the companies are very, very nervous about it. They don't know what's happening to their own hardware and software. They've opened a hole in their network, and that hole can be used by bad guys. The second problem is just what's the government black box doing? You know, what are they sucking in that they're not legally entitled to suck in? There's no accountability. Usually the much better way to do wiretaps is the government gets a court order and then the phone company or whoever implements it, and that way the phone company's looking to make sure it's legal and the government's making sure that it's legal. If you just say to the government, put it in a black box, take whatever you want, an open buffet time, we don't have anyone else who knows what's happening in there, and then problems can build up and no one from the outside ever gets to see what the problems are.
And yet these are already in place. I mean, there was a whistleblower around AT&T last year, as I recall.
Well, so the whistleblower in AT&T, and this is one of the lawsuits that the immunity is about in FISA, the whistleblower said that for a great big hub of data and voice coming in and out of the United States and a lot of domestic phone calls, for a big hub there was a black box, this splitter, and that was being done on phone calls. The new proposal takes it a step further and says, let's not just do it to phone companies, but let's do it through a lot of the rest of the private sector, where we'd have direct feeds into the government computer so they can see what's going on out there. So there's a lot of problems with the illegal black box at the phone company level, and now it's another proposal to say, let's go further and put it into lots of other networks. The government's had a ton of computer security problems on their own computers. Right. If the government's building black boxes to go into all these other places, that's opening up vulnerabilities that are very, very hard to control.
You know what baffles me on this? We're talking with Professor Peter Swire, Ohio State University, and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. PeterSwire.net is website, and AmericanProgress.org. What baffles me about this is that the conservatives, for years and years and years, you know, the mantra has been, you know, get the government out of our lives, get the government, off my back.
Oh, that's right.
You know, blah, 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 blah. And I'm wondering why the movement conservatives, you know, the CPAC conservatives, the serious old line conservatives aren't screaming about this.
Well, you know, a few are. You know, the Ron Paul side of the Republican Party is with the civil liberties folks like you and me on this, right?
Right.
So you see some of it. But I think what's happened is they, you know, say no harm about other Republicans. So they don't fix Katrina and they end up wiretapping and they do all sorts of other things. And it's just party loyalty. And so on the FISA vote, you see no defections by Republican senators. You don't have a single one who's willing to stand up, on the key votes. On a few of the smaller votes, Arlen Specter will, but they're just not even, they're not going to split with party loyalty and their president on this. And so they're big government, they've increased government spending, they've blown the budget deficit, they're surveilling and getting into the lives and the houses of American people, and that didn't fit the conservative story they were trying to tell everybody for a long time. It's bad politics and it's bad process and it's bad everything else, and we just have stuck with it.
Yeah, it's ultimately anti-conservative, anti-liberal, anti-American, in my opinion.
Right.
Certainly anti-constitutional.
There's big constitutional problems, and they've ignored checks and balances. They said Article 2 lets us do whatever we want. Right. And those are sort of broad dictatorial powers, not constitutional powers.
Yeah, this is the John Yee or John Yu or whatever his name is.
John Yu.
John Yu.
Who wrote legal opinions that they will try to use if there's ever criminal prosecutions. They'll try to use those legal opinions to say they can't be prosecuted.
Right. So how do we stop this? We've got about a half a minute, by the way, sir.
I think the main way you stop it is you vote in people that are going to change it, and then you hold those people accountable. So public pressure is always needed, and voice of Air America and people seeing things they don't like and complaining about it helps keep the pressure on so that the people who want to do the right thing have a better chance to do it.
So contact your elected officials even now and say,
elections coming up this year. That's right.
Yeah, no immunity for telcos. And by the way, we don't want black boxes attached to our company computer networks or our ISPs or whatever.
That's right.
Peter Swire.net. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Thank you very much.
27 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls, 866-303-2270.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. Let me take.
Four minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. By the way, Friday of this week, February 15th, I'll be in Reno, Nevada at 5 p.m. at the Borders Bookstore, 4995 South Virginia Street in Reno. Drop by and say hi. And then on Saturday night, I'm giving the keynote speech for the Mensa in California, Los Angeles, at the Hacienda Hotel at LAX. That's on Sepulveda. And for information on that, you can check out K-Talk, and also, or you can call 818-766-5314. Mensa is selling a certain limited number of tickets to K-Talk listeners in Los Angeles to my keynote at the Mensa address. And boy, you want it. It's not very often that I'm keynoting a conference where I'm intimidated to be the keynoter. It's like, you know, here's the official organization of really smart people. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Marty in West New York, New York. Hey, Marty, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'd like to know why our side never follows up on some of the openings they give us. And one example would be, I remember when Romney threw his hat in the ring, the first question he was asked was why his five sons weren't volunteering to fight in the war that he enthusiastically supported. And his phony comment was that they were doing something far more important for the country. They were helping him get elected. Well, he's dropped out of the race. So where's the follow-up on that?
Yeah, excellent question. And hopefully somebody will ask him that, although I doubt anybody's much talking to him these days. But anyhow, Andrew, and thank you. Andrew in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, Tom. Good show once again.
Thank you.
As far as Ralph Nader, my comment would be, if he would use your advice and infiltrate the Democratic Party, join and make the changes from within.
Yeah, I would love to see that. In fact, I would love to see a movement around him doing that. I think he's doing so many other things, and it's just, you know, Ralph's always been a maverick. He's always gone his own way, and I just, you know, for some people, it's just not their style, you know, to be part of you know, something like an organized 200-year-old political party. And you know, unfortunately, you know, but you're absolutely right. That would be the best thing for him to do, in my humble opinion. Sheila in Los Angeles, and I essentially said that to him on the phone. Sheila in Los Angeles. Hey, Sheila.
Hi, Tom. I love your show. I'm always educated when I listen to you.
Thank you.
Something over the last couple of months has really started to distress me, and that's this idea by some of Mrs. Clinton's supporters, the female supporters, that she's being attacked simply because she's a female. And can you imagine if Barack were attacked because he's black? When you make those kind of arguments, I think the sexism argument is always going to lose. I won't go into the history of all that, but I think it's going to lose. It's a losing argument. And I think in many ways, her supporters run the risk of alienating black females, and just maybe the black vote in general when she makes that, or when they make that argument. Because can you imagine that if or when Barack Obama gets the nomination, this man will be so Willie Hortonize that even his mother, if she were alive, would not recognize him.
It's going to happen.
The knives are going to come out.
Yeah. Sheila, I agree. It's going to happen to both of them. I mean, I'm holding in my hands a couple of $3 bills that I picked up at the CPAC conference last week, the big conservative conference. Pictures of Hillary Clinton instead of George Washington in you know, bug-eyed scream mode, you know, very, very unflattering pictures of her.
And the fact of the matter.
And it says the feminist states of America at the top. I mean, it's a queer reserve note is what it says at the very top of that. I mean, they've
Mrs.
already
Clinton
started.
Clinton has always been a lightning rod for people's anger ever since she was the First Lady of Arkansas.
Yeah.
People, for whatever reason, don't like her personally. I think it has less to do with the fact that she's a female than that she is who she is. Mrs. Doe was not attacked when she ran for the presidency. Jolene Ferraro was not attacked when she
ran. You know what I think it is, Sheila, is not so much that she is who she is, but that she's an assertive woman, because the same thing happened to Eleanor Roosevelt, who was very outspoken during the
administration of her
husband.
All I can say is that if this goes on any longer, I may just stay home, which I kind of doubt, or I may vote for McCain. If McCain becomes president, my life will not change in any appreciable way. So,
well, it will when he gets his guys on the Supreme Court, Sheila. Trust me, and it'll be a disaster for all of us. Thank you for the call, though. Flo in Sunrise, Florida. Hey, Flo, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Mr. Hartman. I'm thrilled that I get to talk to you, because now I listen to your show. It's on between 3 and 6 in the morning. I have to wake up and, you know, kind of listen in. There was a conservative that wrote a book about Hillary, and he was just bashing her right and left, and he bashed her health care plan. Well, guess what? We got notification from my husband's company, don't go with Hillary's health care plan. They wanted the HMOs, and look at the mess they turned out to be.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And the fact of the matter is that national health care in the United States is something that is broadly supported in the business community. General Motors has come out and, you know, on a number of occasions, and most of the big auto companies, and said it. I mean, you had Honda, one of those two companies was going to be siting a plant in the United States. This was about 4 or 5 years ago. It happened when I was on the air, but, you know, some time ago. And it looked like there were like three states that were competing with each other. You know, oh, we'll give you $50 million for the tax cuts. No, we'll give you $90 million for the tax cuts. Alabama ended up offering them over $100 million in tax breaks and free land and all this kind of infrastructure and everything else. And it looked like they were going to go with Alabama. And at the last minute, they decided to build their plant in Canada, and which was offering them nothing. Other than, hey, you want to build your plant here? Fine. We got a good, educated workforce.
And their people have a health care plan that the auto industry doesn't have to pay for.
That's right.
And
that's
their main
why they did it.
They don't want to pay for this.
You're absolutely right. Flo,
can I tell you one thing today?
Sure.
I'm taking a Boniva pill. It's $104. And my insurance paid $50. So I called to complain about the price, and they said, take it up with your insurance company. I think it's outrageous that one pill costs $104.
Yeah,
my husband has to work a day for that. It leaves 29 days for all of our other bills.
You know, what's even more outrageous about that is I don't know about that particular drug, but the majority of our drugs are developed by research that is paid for by you and me.
Funding through us.
Yeah, right.
That's what I told her.
Through the National Institutes of Health. Yeah, so most of the research, you know, and then the drug companies do the marketing and whatnot. Flo, thank you so much for the call.
Oh, Mr. Hartman?
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
I called you because there was a report on the business report that Chavez is going to stop selling oil to us if the courts hand over Venezuela's assets to ExxonMobil.
Yeah, I read that this morning. I doubt that he will follow through on that. I don't think that he can handle not having his biggest customer giving him money anymore.
But ExxonMobil leaves these countries with all kinds of pollution. They walk off. They leave the people holding the bill they don't want to pay. Is they have a hold of our country's assets, too, it looks like. They're running a show here at $40 billion a year, $11 billion so far this year.
Yeah, in profits. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Flo, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Oh, my. Marilyn in Utica, Michigan. Hey, Marilyn, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I listen every day. I break my neck to get to the radio and make sure I hear you.
And thank you for listening to us on WDTW there in Detroit.
And I'm usually don't like to call in, but I'm getting upset with these people that are so for Hillary. And I was one of them for so long until I started watching her votes, you know, what she votes for.
Mm-hmm.
She even voted when they were trying to get rid of napalm bombs that take the flesh off of the Iraqis, and she even voted to keep them.
Cluster bombs.
Corporate.
Also, well, I'm not going to defend her. In fact, I condemn her votes. I don't know about the napalm. I frankly didn't know about that. I do know that she voted to keep cluster bombs in the arsenal, which have been banned implicitly, if not explicitly, by international convention and by the UN. And there are a lot of areas.
She's just very corporate, much more than Obama is.
Perhaps. That may well be the case, Marilyn. And each one of us is going to have to look at the voting records of both of these people and make up our own minds on it. Jay in New York. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind today?
Just a comment about a couple of things that happened way back in one of the earlier debates when Hillary had problems with that immigrant question. I think it was in the Philadelphia debate.
Mm-hmm.
And the following week, Obama was asked the exact same question. And it's like he heard it for the first time and totally flummoxed the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I didn't hear any comment about it, but it made me question, how does he prepare for things?
Yeah, well, I don't know. There's no perfect candidates out there, Jay. There's just, you know, there's none. But we have what we have, and we have to make a decision about which, each one of us has to make a decision about which one we're going to vote for. Ben in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Ben, what's up? Ben, you are on the air. I guess we're not. Brian in Ashland, Kentucky. Hey, Brian, got about a minute before our break here. What's up?
Hey, I was calling about the Friends of Coal campaign, the PR campaign that's going on right now,
mm-hmm.
and the lack of coverage. I mean, there's 470-plus mountaintops that have been decapitated,
right.
over 1 million acres of wilderness from Pennsylvania down into North Carolina, and countless people with polluted water. One of the best website I've found is ilovemountains.org. That tells about this. And just as a side note here, the CEO of Massey Energy, Don Blankenship, had a $70 million judgment overturned by a federal judge that he was later, there's pictures of him with this judge on the French Riviera.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. And you noted who sponsored the Democratic and Republican debates on CNN?
Yes, I think
the coal industry. Yeah.
The coal industry.
Yep. Brian, thanks a lot for calling from Ashland, Kentucky there. 45 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman radio program. 866-303-2270 is our telephone number. You want to drop into our live chat room? I'm going to go there and say hi to the folks here during the break. Although you can also listen to our sponsors. Here's your opportunity to support your station. Drop by our live chat room at TomHartman.com or AirAmerica.com. 45 minutes past.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But it's business as usual.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Well, the National Journal has ranked Barack Obama as the most liberal senator in the U.S. Senate. What were the criteria that they used to determine that? Well, time for our conservative alert for the day. Yeah, those wacky folks over at the National Journal. Here are some of the votes by Barack Obama that made him the most liberal Vote number 24 on the amendment to repeal the federal minimum wage by giving states the authority to set minimum wages. The magazine determined that the liberal position was to vote against the amendment, as Obama did. In other words, against repealing the federal minimum wage. Gee, that's terribly liberal. I mean, actually, see, the point is that this isn't like wacky liberal stuff. This is like everybody in America agrees with this stuff. Vote number 56, to table an amendment that would require the Homeland Security Department to screen 100% of cargo containers entering the country within 5 years. Oh, only liberals would support that. Let's screen the cargo coming into this country. Conservatives are opposed to that. Conservatives, yeah. Vote number 73 on passage of the Improving America's Security Act of 2007, which the Journal described as, quote, a bill implementing the 9/11 Commission's Homeland Security recommendations, including a provision extending collective bargaining rights to federal security screeners. So if you're in favor of implementing the 9/11 Commission's Homeland Security recommendations, you're a liberal. If you're in favor of leaving the country vulnerable, you're a conservative. Vote number 127 on passage of Stem Cell Research Enhancement Act of 2007, which the Journal described as, quote, supporting embryonic stem cell research. Oh, yes, that's very liberal. And conservatives, of course, opposed to that. And vote number 307, but Americans are saying, hey, you know, wait a minute, you can cure diseases? Vote number 307, legislation reauthorizing and expanding the state children's health insurance program, the so-called S-CHIP program, what a god-awful acronym, nonetheless. He voted for that, to give more children health insurance, and therefore he's one of the most liberal senators in America. And these conservatives, they are so out of touch, so completely out of touch with mainstream America. You know, sometimes it just boggles my mind. I don't know how to go beyond that. Marcy in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Marcy, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just want to comment on these people who continue to call in saying they're going to vote for McCain. You know, they're throwing a tantrum because they don't like something about Hillary or something about Barack. And
well,
it's like,
truth be told, our earlier caller was the only one who said that, I think, in
at least a week. Well, I mean, not just on your show, perhaps, but on all of the Air America shows and other ones. You know, I hear this all the time. And it's just, they need to stop and think about the Supreme Court nominations, about the war, about everything, and not throw a tantrum. Just make a decision. Who is the better one? Vote for that person. But we have to support the Democrat that runs in the end.
You know, Marcy, during the election of 2004, I was doing this radio program, and we have a message board attached to our website at tomhartman.com. And there were three or four people who started showing up there, just constantly posting Republican talking points and constantly rebutting anybody who was in favor of John Kerry and spreading all the stuff, you know, Swift Boat stuff and all this kind of stuff. And we tracked one of these guys back and found that he had actually, on another message board, talked about how he was being paid 10 cents per post to go on progressive message boards all over the country and post Republican propaganda. And apparently there's a bunch of these sock puppets out there who are being paid. And it wouldn't surprise me if some of the callers who say, yeah, I'm a Hillary supporter, sure I am, but you know, what the hell, I'm going to vote for McCain. Somebody being paid by the Republican Party. Wouldn't surprise me at all, because I've seen it myself on my own message board. In fact, we had a thread there for a long time. Some, you know, an investigative reporter actually tracked down this whole campaign to have these guys out there, you know, paying people to go out and post on blogs.
Yeah, well, we just, you know, I hope you're right, and we just need to understand that whoever gets in there of a Democrat, that we just hold their feet to the fire and we make sure that they continue to do the right thing, and they will if we push them.
Amen. Well said, Marcy. Thanks a lot for the call. Jack in Freehold, New Jersey. Hey, Jack.
Hey, Tom. How you doing? Listen, I wanted to make a comment about the 2000 election regarding Nader's impact, and I think everybody's missing the point. His impact was not in Florida. His impact was in New Hampshire. New Hampshire clearly has become a blue state. Clinton carried it in 92, 96. Bush didn't even carry the Republican primary in New Hampshire in 2000. McCain beat him. And it was, if you looked at the votes, it was the Nader-Gore votes were far more than the Bush votes. Those three electoral votes changed the election.
Hmm. That's interesting. I didn't know that. But thank you. Thanks, Jack. See, I got the smartest listeners in the world, I'll tell you. Everybody's constantly educating me here. I appreciate it. Tony in Michigan. Hey, Tony.
Hi, Tom. To one of your earlier callers, Flo, I'd like to give her some advice. She can save some money and have better health if she would try to achieve better bone health and prevent osteoporosis by eating a healthy diet. Boniva and Fosamax and Evista and those other drugs that are – supposedly going to help her have stronger bones and prevent osteoporosis, don't actually do that. All they do is prevent the body from sloughing off bone cells that are ready for the body to actually get rid of anyway, and just keep them there artificially longer. It right. just inhibits that.
And the two things are a diet that are high in calcium and magnesium, and number one. And number two, a lot of impact-type exercise, which means walking.
Exactly.
If you just walk a lot, and for an elderly person, a lot may just mean, you know, 10 minutes or so, 15 minutes, walk around the block a couple of times. That will have a tremendous impact on the porosity and density of your bones over time, and, you know, a really good thing. Tony, thanks for pointing that out. And hopefully Flo will get the message, and it'll be useful to her. Coming up Tuesday, tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program, I'm taking on Dinesh D'Souza, conservative political columnist and author of his new book, The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11. Oh, man. And Congressman Charles Rangel is going to drop by to talk about the economy. Are we headed for a recession? Are we already there? Plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People, reminding you, hey, get... You. Democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there and get active.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.